Blog Talk Radio. Ali Blue Media and Good Grief Worldwide proudly present Grief Diaries, hosted by Linda Sheldon Fell and Angie Cartwright. Grief Diaries candidly discusses grief, uncensored, as we explore our losses, journeys, hearts, and hope for grievers everywhere. To listen to archived episodes, visit www.griefdiaries.com. And now, your hosts, Linda Sheldon Fell and Angie Cartwright.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Grief Diaries Radio, a show dedicated to the journey known as grief, where we sit, talk, share losses, journeys, hearts, and hope. My co-host Angie's out ill tonight. We wish her a very speedy recovery and look forward to having her join us again next week. I do miss her when she's not joining us. So giving a big shout-out to Angie Cartwright. Hope you feel better. And I offer a heartfelt thank you to all the prayers and healing wishes that went out to my family last Wednesday as my beloved dad suffered a massive heart attack. He did undergo open heart surgery, and he's doing great. It's really a cool story. And my dad had a dream a few days prior to his heart attack that my mom just shared with me a couple days ago, and I was so moved that I shared it on Facebook, and over 100 people have liked it, and quite a few have commented and sharing it, so it's kind of cool. It's real short, and if you want to take a look at my real quick cool story about my dad's dream prior to having a heart attack, you can go to my Facebook page, my public profile Facebook page at facebook.com/powerofonemoment. And join us on Grief Magazine on Flipboard. Flipboard is a cool new social media magazine where you can flip through photos and articles and all kinds of cool stuff right from your desktop, your tablet, your smartphone. You'll never look at a paper magazine again, and you'll save a tree. Ooh, that's cool. I love that. So download the app or go to www.flipboard.com on your browser and search for Grief Magazine, and we'll come up. And join us on there. And if you'd like to write, we welcome contributions. And you can send an email to me. Go to our Grief Diaries page there and click to send me an email if you want to join us on Grief Magazine. And if you're looking for inspiration, healing, and hope, join us at the National Grief and Hope Convention, April 16th to 18th, JW Marriott, Indianapolis. So it's next month, 30 days. It's open to everyone, appropriate for all ages. Tickets are only $35 per session, and we have six sessions, and it's available at www.griefconvention.com. You can get everything you need there, the master schedule, the media, all kinds of stuff, and you can buy your tickets directly through there. And this isn't your average bereavement event. It is filled with nationally known personalities. Some of them have earned awards. Some have written bestsellers. Some are famous, like tonight's guest. Despite their varied background, they all have two things in common, loss and healing. And they know that the power of sharing their inspirational journeys offers the gift of comfort and hope to those who are hurting. And Lord, we know that no one needs hope more than grievers. So join us at the National Grief and Hope Convention next month in Indy. So tonight's guest is a country music legend. Songwriter Richard Lee was born into a home filled with domestic violence that claimed the life of both his parents. At the tender age of 2.5, he was an orphan. And he began writing songs, and by the tender age of 10, he was performing at churches and school functions. By the time he was a teenager, he was playing in music venues. And as soon as he graduated from high school, he hightailed it to Nashville, beautiful, beautiful city. And within a year, he had written Crystal Gayle's first number one hit. And for the younger generation who aren't not familiar with Crystal Gayle, she was a beautiful, beautiful country legend, Loretta Lynn's sister. And she was known for her long hair that some say that it almost touched the ground. And, oh, we all aspire to have hair like Crystal Gayle, or at least I did. And she's had many, many number one hits. And so Richard wrote her very first number one hit. And shortly after that, he wrote her third number one hit, which became the world famous Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue. And to date, his music accomplishments, they're impressive. And Richard, I know you're hanging on here with me, but your list of accomplishments is long. So I got to get through them before I can give you an introduction there. It's going to take a while. No, I'll be fast here. You know, your musical accomplishments really are cool. You've got 8 number one hits, 14 top 10 hits. You are a 4-time winner of Song of the Year, been nominated 7 times, 3-time Grammy nominee, took home the Grammy for the most famous song ever, Don't Make My Brown Eyes Blue, for which Crystal Gayle sang, and she did it beautifully. You are a Country Music Association Award winner for Song of the Year, Song of the Century Award winner. You are only one of 10 songwriters who have ever been awarded Song of the Century, and you have over 50 million records sold. That is pretty impressive, and no wonder you were inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame in 1994. So Richard has written songs for the greatest country artists in history. Ray Charles, George Jones, the Dixie Chicks, Reba McEntire, Emmylou Harris, so many more. So welcome to Grief Diaries Radio, Richard Lee. It's an honor to have you join us tonight.
Thank you so much, Linda.
Are you still with me, or did I put you to sleep going down? Because you've heard all that thousands of times.
No, you did it. You did it pretty much the way I wrote it for you.
Oh, wait a minute.
No, I'm just teasing.
Yeah, that was amazing. Yeah, no, I like to research my guests and get real familiar with their accolades and their stories. And, you know, so I feel like I know you a little bit before we get going on the broadcast. And my goodness, your list was quite impressive. And I was all over the place, all over Google, you know, looking up this and that. And I even, you know, watched a few of your YouTube videos and such. And, you know, it's like, oh, my gosh, I remember that song. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun. So welcome to Grief Diaries.
Thank you very much. You did a very impressive job. And I especially like the fact that you got the title correct on Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue. Most people don't ever get it right. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, I remember it vividly. What do they say?
Well, I don't want to say it because everybody... Oh. what they usually say is, don't it make your brown eyes blue?
Oh.
I don't know why all my life. Oh. Thank you for being one of the first ever to get it right.
Well, I like to do thorough research, and Google led me straight on that one, right?
Yeah.
So, Oh, well, thank you. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful song. And anyone that, you know, I was asking our youngest son is 19 years old, and he just returned home today for spring break. And he's quite musical, a percussionist. And in fact, you know, he came in bounding in the door, you know, his duffel bag full of dirty laundry. And of course, he's greeting all the pets before I get my first hug. And then he goes right to the piano and sits down and starts playing. And, you know, it's just music really is so therapeutic, so beautiful. And but Annie, I had to ask him, I said, well, you know, I've got a really cool guest on my show tonight, bud. You know, his name is Richard Lee, and he wrote the song Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue. And he's like, huh?
Yeah. Blank.
Huh? And I'm like, oh, buddy, this guy, you know, this guy's, he's legendary. So, yeah. So before we start to share your journey through, you know, how music became healing to you, and obviously you were born very gifted, and, you know, how it took you from being an orphan to the Hall of Fame, take us back to your tender years. You were just 2.5 when you became an orphan.
Yeah, I was born to a man who was old enough to be my grandfather, and his sons were old enough to be my father. My father was 60 when I was born. He was
really.
My father was born in 1891. That was, I think, 22 presidents ago. That was at that time there were 144. Miles of paved road in the United States. That was my father. My grandfather was born in 1856.
Wow.
So And my mother was born in 1908. So I was in the wrong generation, and I always felt it. I always felt that I didn't belong anyway when I was growing up. In addition to, it wasn't just being an orphan that made me feel like I didn't belong and that I was rootless and lost. It was that I was the wrong generation, raised in the beginning and loved very dearly by my parents, I understand, and I could feel it very strongly when I was 8 and a half and I moved to my third family, and I was shown pictures of my mother and father, and my heart leapt out of my chest immediately when I
wow.
saw them. I knew who they were. But I started in McLean with this older couple, and they died in a domestic quarrel, as you suggested earlier. My father had he had pneumonia, I think. He had a temperature, according to the article I read on it. He had a temperature of 105 and very deathly ill, and apparently and then I have an eyewitness account too. Myself and my niece were in the house, and my niece, I recently spoke with her about it. She said that she was sleeping with my mother at the time, and my mother was just weeks away from her 45th birthday, and my father is now 62. And
wow.
She went into the room where he was. He was sleeping in a different room. And my niece heard him. She was 6 at the time. She heard a crack. And that turned out to be the report of a 410 shotgun. And apparently she had produced the shotgun for some reason, or he had produced it. No one will ever know. But she died with a shotgun blast to her chest. And my niece came in and got me, 2 and a half, and led me out. And as I went by my father's study, and she went by, he was hanging from the rafter. He had thrown a rope over the pine rafters and put one chair upon the other and kicked one away, and he was hanged himself. And but I asked her, I said, Ghislaine, this is only a couple of years ago. I lost my family for a long time, but that's a long story. But I said, Ghislaine, we were separated for over half a century. I said, did I really see it, or did these other people put this image in my head that what I think I saw, my mother on the floor, shot in the chest, and my father hanging himself? And she said, yes, you did, Richard. And you said, bad daddy, bad daddy.
Oh, goodness.
Ill. And we went down the hill and knocked on the door of my older half-brother. He was, he was born in 1916. He was 35, 37, 37 years old. He had a little family of his own. And they went in, and the rest, you know, then it was declared a murder, suicide. And the courts awarded me to him, my half-brother, who I really didn't know, and his wife, who was apparently a substance abuser. And so that was a heck of a place to start over, and it was a very difficult existence. And then she was usually passed out on the floor, bless her heart. And she finally, sadly, a few years later, as I was mentioning earlier, she was smoking in bed and caught herself on fire, and she died. It took her She died on Good Friday. I remember that, and she had agonized for 2 weeks.
Wow.
From her burns. So at 8 and a half, three of my first four parents of the seven I would have had died violently. And I was beginning to think, and I never felt welcome at that other house, by the way. My brother, he was an alcoholic, and she was a drug addict. And I slept with the maid. I lived in the attic for a time. These were very successful people. My father was a very successful author, and he was also had worked closely with President Eisenhower.
Okay.
And that's why we lived in Washington. But then after that, I went to live with my other half brother and his wife. Then they divorced, and then she remarried some years later. And so by the time I was 15, I'd had four fathers and three mothers.
Wow.
And, you know, I had, you know, calling mom, pop, all these different people. Finally, I just said, I'm not calling anybody mom or pop anymore. I'm just call you by your name. But it created a very interesting thing for me. I mean, if you could imagine every few years packing up and going to live with somebody else. I know a lot of people have done that, but it's hard.
Right.
People you call your brothers and sisters, you never see them again. So I took up songwriting.
So you felt like a misfit in every home.
I felt like a Jonah also. I felt like if I came to live with you, somebody was going to die.
Oh, my goodness.
I remember as a little boy, I was 10, and they were taking me to school, a school bus. I couldn't look at a funeral home. I had to go by it every day on the way to school. I would not look at it. I was so traumatized by death. But I pulled myself up on a piano stool when I was about five and touched those magical keys, and something just lit up inside me, and I knew there was magic there, and it was healing. And then I began, for some reason, to be fascinated by every instrument I ever saw. And I saw a fellow with a guitar, and that changed my life. And I started begging everybody for a guitar, and I finally got one at age 10. And almost immediately began writing songs, because it was healing to me. But by the time I was 14, I was cranking them out. And I was learning something by accident. Well, I'm a self-taught musician. I kept it kind of to myself. But I started realizing that when I told my story, I didn't feel so chaotic inside. I began to feel a sense of peace. And as I grew older and wrote better songs, I noticed that I hurried up the process. I went ahead and started digging for my chaos, because when I did, it was a very healing and liberating and cathartic feeling to put it in a song, bottle it. And I owned it after that. And I learned that if I could tell my story, a couple of things happen. If I tell my story, I own it. And if I keep it secret, it owns me. I learned that. And then I realized that when I tell my story and I sang it, like the greatest man I never knew, Reba McEntire's hit that I wrote with Lang Martin Jr., that was, I don't think that song could be numbered how many people have felt healed by that, how many times people have come up crying to me, and how many letters Reba got about it, and it's a very powerful song, and it's very odd. Only only someone who had lived with a lot of fathers could have written it.
Right, right. But, and that was, yeah, that song was pretty powerful. And
yeah.
So for our listeners who haven't heard it, you can watch it on YouTube.
And what I learned is when you do tell your story, other people want to tell theirs. And by doing that, it is released in them, and they own their story, where they had kept it secret all their lives, you know, and then they say these very freeing things. It's a very, very supernatural and magical thing that I've been thrilled to be a part of.
Well, you're right. It is very, very powerful. And I think anyone who creates, you know, whether you write a song through your grief, if you write articles or books through your grief, it touches you on many, many levels.
Mm-hmm.
And then it touches others on many, many levels, the readers, the listeners. And it's healing for both the giver and the receiver.
Exactly.
And
that was my experience.
Yeah, yeah. And so you taught yourself how to play those instruments, including the guitar.
Yes, ma'am, I sure did.
Okay, so you didn't have any, I'm guessing because you had different homes and such, you didn't, no one took the time to say, wow, you're really gifted, let me get you piano lessons.
It was just the opposite. I was not the fair-haired child in any of the many families I lived in. Well, except my original one, my primary family. My parents loved me. But I was a burden to everybody else, and I knew it until I found Mary Kilby, who was then Mary Lee, married to one of my brothers, one of my half-brothers, and she saved my life. And she didn't have a lot of time to do things musically, but she was an artist, and she understood the power of art, and so she allowed me to do that. She didn't have time to. She had four other children, so she didn't have time for that. But I watched my half brother play the piano, and I memorized where his hands were positioned. And would play after he was gone. I didn't do a lot.
Right.
I didn't ask people things. I was so shy that, and spoke so little that in the beginning I was told later that in my growing up, a lot of the people thought I was retarded because they were worried because I couldn't speak. I was in shock.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I came out of my little dark world by these songs. I let them carry that pain around. And then I had to live in the shadow in the house below the house where my father had created this great tragedy. And, you know, I lived with shame every day. I looked up at that house. I knew what had gone on there, and everybody in town knew. It was horrible.
Horrible.
And it was...
There's no words for that.
Yeah, and it was torturous, and I had to keep it to myself. And I wasn't really allowed to grieve for my parents. It was very interesting that when you called me, I thought, this is great, because I don't know if this happens to some of the other listeners out there, but I was forbidden to grieve.
That, yes.
This was,
we hear that a lot.
Do you?
We do.
I thought, what a damaging thing to do to a child. Don't let them grieve, you know. Well, I finally did find a way to grieve through my songs, and it was surreptitious, but I got it out. And I later...
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry.
I finally got it all out in my 30s. Took that long, and I finally just had a, you know, grieve for people you're ashamed of? You know, that's hard. And it's hard for people to understand why you're doing that.
Well, and good. And you know, in this day, grief continues to be something that is very antiquated. It's very misunderstood. And there is a large movement that's growing. And many people are on this movement to bring grief out of the dark, as we call it, and into the light, making it a little more understood. And what happens, if we talk about it openly and candidly, people understand it a little bit better. And when that happens, the support offered to grievers improves. And you can't improve upon something if you don't understand it. And you can't understand something if you don't talk about it. And there are many, many people, you know, in our culture, in our nation, who still suffer in silence. And silent grief can be deadly grief. But what I wanted to ask you is, so you know, all through your childhood, going from home to home and feeling truly like a lost soul, no matter where you went, you didn't feel like you were actually, you know, a vital, important part of the family. And then you graduate from high school, and within the year, you take off for Nashville.
Actually, I took off for college. I put myself through college. Then
okay.
The day I finished my last exam at Virginia Commonwealth University, I only went 1 year there. I got through college in 4 years, a lost journey. Started off as a forest ranger in a community college in North Carolina. I realized that wasn't for me. There wasn't enough creative thought. So I went to a Virginia Highlands Community College in Abingdon, Virginia, and started there a liberal arts program, and then I went and finished at VCU in Richmond. Then I went straight to Nashville. I mean, I didn't wait around for commencement or anything. I said, mail my diploma to this address, and I headed to Nashville. And within a year, yes, I had I'll Get Over You for Crystal Gayle, number one record, and also nominated for Song of the Year by the CMA.
So why did you take that time to go to college?
That's a really good question. I had promised the woman who had finally adopted me when I was 15, Mary Kilby, better late than never, said, Richard, you know, I know how much you love this music and everything, but you really need something to fall back on, she said.
Mm.
So I loved her dearly, and still do. She's still alive, thank the Lord. And I did it so she'd be proud of me. And so I went and got a degree in the arts. But
that's beautiful.
And it gave me it became a supernatural piece of help. Without her suggesting that, and without my love for her, and my finally being loved by someone, and I wanted to make her happy and to pay her back some way. So I went to college, put myself through college, working, and by doing so, I inadvertently get pulled into the State Theater of Virginia, the Barter Theater in Abingdon, and I begin working in these bit parts at the theater, and eventually I get my equity card, actor's equity. I'm a paid actor when I'm 21, working with New York actors. I changed my major to the theater, and they begin using me in singing parts and guitar parts, because in this little town they know I'm a folk singer and a writer. And so I never would have had the opportunity to bring my music so far forward so early. I mean, a professional at 20, 21, that was pretty exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
So I started just dreaming of Nashville openly and writing professionally. And there was a knock at my door. I lived in the inn, the Barter Inn, where the actors lived. And it was a person from Nashville. And they that was visiting my next door neighbor in the hotel, in the inn. And I played songs for her, and she said, "You need to come to Nashville. You have ability, and I want you to meet my friends." And so who does she introduce me to but all the people that not only shaped Crystal Gayle's career and Garth Brooks's career and countless more. My life turned on a dime. So if I hadn't gone to college and hadn't gone to Abingdon, Virginia Highlands Community College, it would have taken me longer, I think.
Sure, sure. Well, that, you know, in theory, that makes sense. So, Richard, you know, because you had come from such a raising where your life was very disjointed and you never felt completely a blended part of the family, how was it for you when your life did change on a dime? Was that hard for you to adapt to suddenly people wanting you, people wanting your time, wanting your ability to go from, you know, being the fly on the wall, not ever asking for anything, from suddenly people, you know, wanting you? How was that transition?
That's a very good question. It was very shocking and unbelievable. I didn't trust it when I saw it. But my life turned on a dime twice. You know, I mean, first, November 1st, 1953, when my father and mother died. And talk about your life. My father was an extremely wealthy man, extremely wealthy for his time, he had created this kingdom. I mean, I was an heir. I had stuff that was coming to me, and I lost it all. I had a nice life ahead of me financially. And then it turned on a dime again when the woman I call my mother saved my life spiritually and made sure that, I remember she took me to church and she said, you know, she was a regular churchgoer, and she said, she looked up at the cross and she said in the altar, and she said, "Richard, I know you have a lot of problems," and said, "I can't always help you solve them, but he can. Come here for your things." And that, and you know, I hung on her every word, so I did that, and it also changed my life, and I started recognizing the supernatural help I was getting. And I mean, my career did, and then it turned on a dime in Nashville, and suddenly relatives that used to be ashamed of me and my shame and story were claiming me.
Ah.
People I hadn't heard from in 30 years.
They came
years.
Out of the woodworks.
Uh-huh. They started, "Hey, you know," and I went, "What? You know, what is this? I don't trust this at all." But I started hearing from people, from really great people too, that had lost me. And I was able to be found by these famous, well, temporarily famous songs. You know, songs that are out there. And people are able to locate you. My family started coming to me. My books that my father had written started coming to me in the mail. Portraits of my whole lost life was coming to me through people.
How did that feel?
It felt great. I started piecing. I was starting to learn who I was and who I came from, and I wasn't something to be ashamed of. I really had an interesting life. My mother's uncle turned out to be, her uncle was the 9th president of France. My mother was a French woman my father met in World War II. I started, he was the chief historian for the army during World War II. He was the chief historian. That was, his job was to compile the brief history of the war. And he worked directly under General Eisenhower at the time. And, all of a sudden, I was going, I'm not the son of some awful people. I'm the product of some really wonderful people who had a really bad day.
Fair enough. And so how long did it take you to begin trusting that this new life that changed on a dime was going to stick with you?
It took a while. Yeah, it took several years. I really clung to any money I got, and I was very careful with my finances. I was still that orphan mentality in my 20s. But in my 30s, I started to see that it wasn't going away, and I was surrounded with kindred spirits to songwriters like myself. And art was not considered a hobby where I was now. It was considered a job, and a real job, and you could make a handsome living at it. But where I came from, music and painting, two things I could do. I could paint and I could write. And it was always the first thing that they always cut in school budgets. And it was always the thing they said, well, that's nice, but it doesn't really count. So not only did I not count as a human being in anybody's family, my talents weren't worth anything, they were telling me. So when I got down to Nashville, especially in Abingdon in college there, when I was pulled out of the hallway to be an actor. I mean, this was took me a while to believe it, but in my 30s I started realizing that there is a small percentage of the population that does this for their job, and I was ecstatic that I'd get to be a part of it.
Go ahead. You've referenced a few times about supernatural help. How so?
Well, I remember when to get into the Hall of Fame 20 years and 1 month after you arrive in town is pretty phenomenal. I don't know anyone who got in that fast. I mean, as soon as I get there, I have a publishing deal. Most people wait a year, two, three, seven. Within 30 days, I had a publishing agreement. A year later, a number one. By the time I'd been there 3 years, I'd had two Song of the Year nominations. I'd won a Grammy and a CMA award in 36 months.
Did you think it was deserved, or because you had a beautiful, beautiful natural talent?
No, I didn't think. I thought, I'm just not that smart. This is something's going on. I remember when Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue was finished as a record. And I remember going, I went to church one morning, and I said, well, you know, Lord, I've got this single coming out, and it sounds like something from the 1940s, and I'm really worried about it. And I said, I remember there was a fellow once who prayed the same prayer, and it worked for him. I'm going to try it. I said, my song sounds so odd. Will you just make it, Lord, sound really good, like a hit to everybody else, that the oddness about it is wonderful and not awful? Something like that. And that thing, it just took off unlike anything anyone's seen before or since. It was being spun on the radio almost the day it arrived at DJ's offices. It was number one, and it went up the charts, I think, in 4 weeks to number one. Then it got on the pop chart at 100 and went all the way to number one. It was selling 250,000 units a day a week, when 250,000 units was phenomenal for a year. You know, it was going crazy. So I was just a part of it. I was just the songwriter. But people were telling me, you're not supposed to have that many number ones so close together and to be critically acclaimed and win the awards when you're 25. You know, it's just
when you hadn't paid your dues in their eyes.
But I'd paid them in life, hadn't I?
You had, and you know, little known to them, you had long paid your dues and more than your fair share. I want to make sure I understand something. Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue was not written about a girl.
you did didn't you?
It was written about your dog. And what kind of dog was it?
Amanda was a little wire-haired terrier, a little black and white wiry terrier. And she was cute as anything, and she just was very fond of me and sat at my feet every day when I'd write. I'd sat on this couch every day in my little apartment to write. And I was working on the song, and at that time it was called something about rainbows turning to blue. Don't it turn my rainbows blue? You know, when losing you, I just thought that it was a beautiful thought of all these colors of a rainbow washing to one sad blue color. And I looked down at my dog, and Amanda, who was named after the first song I ever heard when I came to Nashville, written by Bob McDill. And I looked at her big brown eyes, and I went, "Nah, rainbows, heck with that." I said, "Brown eyes turning blue, that's cool."
And the rest is history.
Yeah, it was funny.
How long did you have that dog?
I had her about 9 years. It was wonderful. And then she finally died. Just everybody loved her too much. All the neighbors, she would make the rounds of the neighborhood, and they'd give her scraps, and that kind of did her in. But she was such a dear. She was so smart. And oddly enough, in the end, a couple of years before she died, she was always chasing cars, and especially the garbage truck. And one day she caught a rock in the eye from the garbage man was hurling rocks at the dogs and got her right in the eye.
Really?
And doggone if that her brown eye didn't turn blue, because when...
Really?
Yeah.
Because she went blind. Yeah.
When they go blind, they lose. And I thought, supernatural. And I just thought, and it just... those kind of things just follow me around, and I have a million stories like that to tell.
Boy, you know, well, I'm a pet lover. And so when I stumbled across that, that you had actually, it was your dog that inspired the title for that song and the changing of the words, you know, my heart went out. I you know, as a griever myself, having lost a daughter, you know, we've got our fair share of pets, and boy, they really heal the heart unlike anything else can. And so that really touched me. And I can't help but wonder, back when the song hit number one, first in the country charts and then in the pop charts, and, you know, Crystal Gayle and her long hair everywhere, and everyone wanted to be like her, and, I mean, the most gorgeous voice. Did anyone know that it was your dog that inspired that?
No.
Or were they all just transfixed on Crystal Gayle and her long, beautiful hair?
Yeah,
and the beautiful song?
Fixed on her, I'm sure, because I even was. I thought she was just absolutely one of the most beautiful people singing at the time. She's just a wonderful human being and a beautiful, beautiful woman. And so, yeah, we were all fixated on her. We didn't worry about the story or the song.
Poor Amanda got no credit.
She got high praise from me. When she died, they asked if I was away on vacation. They asked, did they want me to, should they hold the body of the dog till I got back? And I said, no, go ahead and dispose of her body, but keep her collar for me. And so she gets credit because around the Grammy right now for Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue hangs her little blue collar and her tag.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, next time I get to Nashville, I'm going to have to take a look at that.
I'd be happy to show it to you.
Oh, that's precious.
Sentimental thing for me.
Yes.
My little co-writer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So why do you call songs 3-minute miracles?
Because the first of all, they saved my life. They truly did. And they continue to heal me when some new problem comes along. But when they become a hit, when something, you know, that's so intangible, you can't touch it, but it'll touch you. It's something mystical about that, first of all. But the other thing is that, you know, they last 3 minutes, approximately, and they change your life and change the life of people who listen to them, change the life of the man who writes them, or the woman, of course. And they surmount insurmountable odds in the music business. If you think of this for a second, I write a song, and I have no connections to speak of, and yet it goes all the way to number one and becomes this song, I'll Get Over You, for instance. It goes to number one as nominated song of the year. The odds were astoundingly high against it. Here's some of the other things that they might not have been able to surmount. Say you take a song and you give it to the wrong person. It was a great song, but you gave it to the wrong person, and they liked it enough to sing it, and they bruised it. They left it on a pile of bruised songs. They didn't capture it. But so I get to take it to the right producer, who hands it to the right, by my great fortune, to the right singer. On the right label, he chose the right band. He chose and the label chose the right promotion man. And on and on and on. And it's a miracle to make it to number one, one of the 52 songs a year, that 52 songs, and for instance, some songs are number one, like Brown Eyes, for 4 weeks. So, just the way they get over these impossible odds and beat them, because they're magical, they have some fairy dust sprinkled on them. It's just, to me, they're miracles. And then they go on paying your way for years and years. This thing you can't even touch. You can't.
But it can touch you.
But it can touch you. It's miraculous to me.
That's beautiful. That is very poetic and very beautiful and very authentic. And thank you for explaining that. Because I know, you know, you do speak around the nation from time to time. You're still quite busy, actually. But you do speak from time to time, and your keynote is called 3-Minute Miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And now I understand. That's really profound, actually. And, it's somewhat aligned with something I do called the Power of One. And the Power of One is where one song can change your mood.
Mm-hmm.
True?
True.
One smile can change your day. One turn can change your entire journey. And so we all have in us the power to be that power of one moment for someone else. We, you know, be it large or small, we all hold the power to impact someone else's life in a single moment with one word, one smile, one gesture. And
that's pretty
profound, you know. It can change someone's mood, their day, and sometimes even their life. And so that 3-Minute Miracle reminds me of that a little bit. And you know, the beauty of these, you know, just one song can really change so much. And that ripple effect changed entire journeys. You know, it did for you.
Oh, it did.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
I love what you said about hope, bringing hope to people. That is...
Yeah.
It takes a miracle to bring hope. It takes one smile, one song. It just, hope isn't just laying around there for you to pick up. It needs supernatural help to make it to you. And songs are supernatural. Paintings, dance.
Yeah, indeed.
You know, it's just, and they belong to God. All those beautiful. I read one time, not read, but I took a course, the Myers-Briggs Personality Test.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
It was life-changing for me.
Really?
Yes, because I was on the vestry at St. Paul's Church in Franklin, Episcopal Church there, and I didn't know that personality types spoke in such different languages. I thought it was, again, because I was... a orphan, foster kid, and that I just did, I was out of sync with the world. I said, no, Myers-Briggs said, and I'll never forget, they divided us up, and they said, okay, all these people, you know, they had those four letters, and so all the kind of, I call them hamsters in the cage over there, and there was a great deal of them. They're the worker bees, you know, the guys that get everything done. And there's the soaring eagle type personality that has a big overview. And then there's a blend of the two. And this was to help us communicate around in the vestry, the elders of the church. And so then they said, here are the intuitive feelers. Well, there were like two out of 12. And I turned to the woman, and everybody was standing in a different corner. And I turned to her and went, I always liked you. And she laughed and said, I always liked you too. And it turns out that only about all the art, music, culinary things, theaters, songs, poetry, all professionally done is done by about 7% of the population. Hence, 93% of the population votes in sports programs rather than art and music.
Oh.
And it was a very freeing experience for me to learn that.
Right. Boy, that's pretty powerful.
And not only was my job an important one, that I was an artist, and that not only was it okay for me to do it, which they always okayed it reluctantly. It's not only okay, it was my duty to do it. I was only, and because I thought, out of that 7%, half of them will be talked out of doing their art because people around them, the 93%, say it's not a real job. So half of them,
right.
Half of them get talked out of it. And so it's your duty to write a book and to do what you do because you're in that rare group, a small group, and it's a much maligned group, but we do it anyway.
Yeah. Boy, you certainly have a gift with words yourself and, you know, describing things and how they lay out, and that's such a beautiful thing. But, you know, going back to hope and talking about the convention, you know, it's been said that without grief, there would be no need for hope. They go hand in hand.
Nice, yeah.
And you can't have hope without knowing grief. And, you know, when you talk about grief and bereavement and such, it's really a two-part thing. You've got to validate the grief, and then you've got to, you know, find a way to create that hope. And the beauty of you speakers presenting at the National Grief and Hope Convention, you're sharing your profound journeys from tragedy to joy. And what you're doing is gifting the hope for a better future for those who are behind you on that journey, still in the dark. And that is a very, very beautiful thing. So, you know, you can't have hope if you don't know grief. And so for those of us who found our way through the darkness and into the light, it is our job to hold that door of hope open for others who don't have the energy or they don't have the support around them to do it for them. And...
Perfect.
Yeah, yeah. So I look forward to seeing you in Indianapolis here in just a few short weeks. I really do. It's been a treat having you on the show and, you know, sharing your heart with us tonight. It touches me deeply, actually, when you talk about things like, you know, your dog Amanda. And those are the little details that make all the difference in the world. That's what brings people in to your story. And you once said that you work from your own experiences because it makes it possible to put details in and make it believable. Without details, people are tipped off that it's just fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would venture to say that's why your songs have risen to fame the way they have, is because you are writing from the heart. You write, you know, the little details that make it believable. And you know, when you write a song that's inside you, you get it out, but there's many others that might feel that same song. They might say that's my song. You know, he wrote it, he sung it, or she sung it, but they're singing it's what I had in my heart too.
That's the most wonderful compliment I can ever get, is when someone says, "That's my song. You wrote my song."
Yeah.
And I kid them and I say, yeah, songwriters are just human Hallmark cards. We're trying to say for you what you can't say.
Boy, that's beautiful. I'd never heard that one. I love it. I love it. Boy, that's the truth, though. You know, you have a gift with putting words in the right order to the right music to tell someone's story. And there's nothing more beautiful than that. So, Richard, it's been an honor to have you on Grief Diaries tonight and sharing your story with our listeners. Truly an honor, and I really do look forward to meeting you in person in Indianapolis in just a few short weeks here in April. And to our listeners, if you'd like to connect with Richard, you can visit his website at richardleigh.com. That's www.richardleigh.com. or you can find him on Facebook at Richard Lee Music. Or better yet, come to see him in person at the National Grief and Hope Convention, Saturday, April 18th at the JW Marriott, Indianapolis, where he'll be given his keynote, 3-Minute Miracles, From Orphan to the Hall of Fame. Tickets are available directly from the convention website at www.griefconvention.com. And next week, we talk with the funniest widow on earth, Carol Scabelli, author of Poor Widow Me, a lovely, lovely lady, very dear to my heart. So join us, same time, same place, next week, right here on Grief Diaries Radio. Have a wonderful week, everyone. Good night, Richard.
Good night, Linda. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
The
Look
Grief
forward to
Diaries
seeing you.
Radio Show is brought to you by Ali Blue Media and Good Grief Worldwide, an official partner of National Grief Awareness Day, working to bring grief out of the darkness into the light. For more information about Grief Diaries or to listen to archived episodes, please visit www.griefdiaries.com.